Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in a royal city more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today, I bring you conversation from others in the form of the first ever Mayor's Dialogue on Poverty, which took place at City Hall on Wednesday, October 25th. The main speaker was Guelph Wellington Bridges Out of Poverty facilitator and Wellington Dufferin Guelph public health nurse, Elaine Weir. The aim of the talk was to reorientate our thinking of poverty and poverty issues, how we're sometimes quick to graft our own experiences and backgrounds on those suffering poverty, and thus undermining the effort to help them. Poverty issues and how we look at them is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, for decades, we've heard terms like war on poverty, and we've seen governments set the goal of eliminating poverty in 5 years or by the end of the decade or whatever. Laudable, and goals we should be working for to be true. But how close have we gotten to achieving those goals? Has poverty not gotten even more insurmountable in this day and age as income inequality spreads a further gulf between the rich and the poor, and as wages have been stagnant for decades, even though the cost of living goes ever upwards? Now, not for nothing, people have gotten even more cantankerous about money matters and the social safety net. The criticism can be so delightfully summed up in the phrase, "I've got mine, so F you," meaning that so long as I'm taken care of, everyone else can go rot. Never mind that this is a narrow vision for society in general, but it speaks to the temperament and limited vision of modern life and perhaps plays perfectly into something that Elaine Weir gets at in her talk, that if someone is poor, then it's all their fault. That's the thinking. The societal and systemic causes of poverty are well documented, though. But there's still a need for a program like Bridges Out of Poverty, who provide a framework designed to educate individuals from the middle or upper income classes and what it means to live in poverty. She aims to point out the absurdity of applying middle class economic norms to the poor, how a lack of reliability in resources can create the wrong impression of people in poverty as lazy, and how being poor sometimes means doing more work for more money, and not the opposite. A lot of people will listen to this and hear nothing that they haven't heard before, but others will get a new insight into what poverty means to those living in it, and how it's relatively easy for us to start changing things for the better. So this week on the Guelph Politicast, we join in the much-needed quest to make issues of poverty more a priority. Weir's talk offers a lot of anecdotes and examples on how common our misconceptions are about the poor, not to mention how often they're incorrect. If we're going to solve poverty, then we have to begin by understanding it, and this talk lays things out rather clearly. Nothing is necessarily solved except our preconceptions. Rome wasn't built in a day, as they say. But it did have to start with the understanding of how to build a city. So solving poverty means those of us with the ability to do something have to make sure we understand the issues. So without further ado, here is Elaine Weir talking to the community about poverty matters at City Hall.
It's truly my pleasure to be here to present to the city and interested members, and especially our business community. It really is a framework to understand why people who are under-resourced, appropriately or enough resourced, to being well-resourced, and why our behaviors change. So yes, our mom raises us, but so does our money. Okay, so money actually raises of just actually how much you can do. And if you're very wealthy, you tend to spend time telling middle income how they can be wealthy too. You know, you should have got into property, or you should have got into this. But if I don't have the resource base, it's very hard for me to do it. So I will tell you, I've been trying to be a millionaire my whole life, and I think I must just be, maybe, I don't know, too lazy to get there, or I just don't have the skills. So it's really important to keep in mind that high-income people tell middle-income people how to spend their money, and middle-income people tell low-income people how to spend their money. And we can't spend our money differently because we only have the resource we have, and that forces us to spend the money the way we spend it. Sometimes we all speak the same language, but we mean different things. I was sitting in Tim Hortons waiting for one of my clients. We know that our under-resourced people no-show us at a much higher rate than our resourced people. So at 10 o'clock when she didn't arrive, I decided I would wait a half an hour in case she missed a bus and will be a half an hour late. Maybe she has no minutes on her phone and she was not able to call me to tell me she was late. So I look out the window and I see this gentleman trying to cross the very, very snowy parking lot. And he's got his walker with him and he's pushing it as he goes and he looks like he's grumbling, pushing, looking up, pushing. I think, because I often try to think that I read other people's minds, I think that he is actually looking for the curbs. That because the snow is all down and it's a white environment, he can't see where the curbs are while he's walking with his walker. At one point, he looked very frustrated, and he actually hit someone's car. And I kind of looked around like, ooh, does anyone own that car? But he finally makes his way into Tim's. He walks by my table, he sits down, and he is grumbling. Then he looks at the line. I'm in Stone Road, Tim Hortons. That line is never going to get shorter. Right? A couple minutes later, he looks at the line again. Mind read, I'm assuming he's waiting for that line to get shorter. So I go up to him and I said, sir, can I wait in line? And when I get up front, you can come and buy your coffee. What'd you saying? I said, sir, I could wait in line so you don't have to wait with your walker, and then when I get up there, you can buy your coffee. What'd you want from me, woman? I said, can I buy you a coffee? He said, 2 milks, 2 sugars. So asking the right question, not maybe meaning the right thing. So again, keep your minds open to communication. Our background, our education, our societal experiences change our language. And sometimes even though we're all speaking English, our ideas are changed by the experiences we've had. So what is Bridges Out of Poverty? It is the approach that helps employers, community organizations, social service agencies, and individuals to understand and address poverty in an organized way. So we have biases, we're human beings, we judge. How can, if we know more, would we judge less? This initiative helps educate, engage the community in a broad base effort to change local conditions, and this increases opportunities that will enhance movement out of poverty. There are many causes of poverty. And because there's many causes of poverty, there has to be many, many strategies to address it. If we blame the individual for their condition of being in poverty, we in fact don't have to change anything we're doing. It's your fault. You got yourself into poverty, not my fault. So as an individual or a community member, I don't have to engage if I believe it's the fault of the individual. But there are community conditions that cause poverty. There is exploitation in our environment that causes poverty. And there are political and economic decisions that are made that affect how well people do in their financial world. So one senator in the States, he said, well, our biggest group of poor people are single women. What if we had a marriage incentive program and they would be less poor? He put it in place. He offered money to get married. Everyone got married. They took the money. And next year, what happened? The highest rate of divorce and even more domestic violence. So again, you can't take one strategy and say this will work. So we know living wage is coming and it's going to be rolled over the next few years. We know that there's pilot projects with basic income. These are strategies to help with poverty, but we can't stop there. So we have to have more strategies to help. So you can look under those categories. And the other story that I want to tell you is I really needed to leave this conference I was at. And I wanted to go so badly. I don't really know why. But when I get out, I have a flat tire. and we have rim on asphalt flat. What is my knowledge? Don't drive on a flat tire. That's what I know. I wanted to get home so badly that I thought, how bad could it be? So I get in my car and I start driving. Okay, it was bad. It feels like I'm pushing a wheelbarrow. Doesn't matter, I keep going. I speed up. When I got onto Highway 6, people were blowing their horns. Lady, flat, lady, you have a flat. I'm like, I know, thanks. And continued to drive. I started to speed up because I was embarrassed that so many people were telling me I should pull over. My tire shred, the rim ignited a spark on the asphalt, and I started a fire. So now I am forced to pull over. So when I'm pulled over and I'm throwing the snow on my tire, people are looking at me like, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? So I don't have a cell phone, so I go into Radio Shack and I said, can I use your phone? And they said, is that your car? I don't want to look back. I'm like, yes, that's my car. Don't you know you shouldn't drive on a flat tire? I said, yes. Can I use your phone? So he gives me the phone. He grabs his friend. They both stand at the door. And they're like, can you believe it? Look what she's done, right? So the next guy comes into the store and he goes, is that your car? And I said, yes, that's my car. Don't you know you shouldn't drive on a flat tire? Yes, I know that. The third guy came in and he said, is that your car? And I said, it is, and if you want to laugh at me, that group over there is having a great time. He goes, I don't want to laugh at you. I want to help you. Do you have a spare? So we went out. He put that spare on my car. He told me to cancel my call to CAA. And I said to him, I offered him money. He refused. I said to him, thank you so much for helping me where I am and not how I got here. And he says, this so looks like something my wife might have done. So that aside, that message is so important. How do we help people where they are and not how they got there? You know, if you didn't buy cigarettes, you'd have more money for food. If you didn't buy that iPhone, you would have more money for your rent. If you didn't, then you would. This is not helpful if I'm already there. Would you feel that my bad decision of driving on a flat tire should have left me there for the rest of my life? Whoa, that was a bad decision. Elaine, live it. No, we get to make bad mistakes, and because we're resourced, we can recover. We are no different than people of poverty, but when people of poverty make a judgment call and it didn't work out well, they have more dominoes that fall than when you're resourced. So it was an expensive mistake. I had to buy a new tire, obviously, but I had to buy a new rim too because they couldn't get a tire to fit the destroyed rim that I have. So I want you to look at the causes of poverty and in your organization, in your individual life, how do you start making change? To look after what this looks like in your community. Because when we have any poor in our community, it hurts all of us. What does it mean for businesses? Internally, people of poverty, their dominoes will fall more often. So you have a skilled person, you want them hired, and yet when you do hire them, they maybe have more relationship demands than someone who's resourced. And then that will increase your turnover rates and your orientation expenses. You will have attendance issues, so now you have to do attendance management. You might have some work efficiencies while someone learns that this is a process that someone's put in place, but there's two parts of it that seem silly or redundant. So, you know, people who are chronic and constant problem solvers go, well, that's stupid, why do I have to do that piece? But everyone else is plugging along because it's part of the process. But people of poverty will question it more. They're concrete problem solvers. They solve problems every minute of every day. So they see things in work or organizations that look efficient. So they might tell you that more. Maybe you don't like to hear that. Maybe you think that's stepping up or stepping over. There could be more employee conflicts. So I honestly don't believe that I have had this much impact, but after I presented my Full Bridges presentation, a guy came down and he says, I think you've saved my marriage. So, you know, when we're evaluating bridges, I'm putting that one in, okay? Because that is, you know, quite an accomplishment. But he went on to say that him and his wife were both raised in poverty, generational poverty. But someone took interest in him because he was a solid worker and he had a dream of owning a business. And he became a business owner and he owned a car cleaning and laundry business together. He became involved in the business world, in the Chamber of Commerce, in networking with other people who might want their cars or clothes cleaned. So he actually was exposed to the business world on a regular basis. Even though they had a beautiful house with a pool and drove good cars, he goes, why does my wife still act poor? Why can't she act middle income? Then he heard my presentation. Then he understood. He had been exposed to middle income, so he was now straddling two different sets of rules. His wife, though she had access to more things, she was at home caring for the children. So she didn't access middle income other than with the goods, what we have. So her personality and ideas were still a lot from that generational poverty. So it made him understand her in a way that he was ready to go back and say, I get it, I get it. A student from UAG came down after and she said, I've already put in my change of accommodation because my roommate was driving me nuts. She goes, she's generationally poor and I'm generationally middle income and I so get it now. And so withdrew her request and wanted to stay with her roommate and learn more about the hidden rules of different income groups. So this will affect your bottom line. If I can't find a way to reduce those employee conflicts and I can't reduce my turnover rate or my absenteeism, then that affects the bottom line. Externally, people who live in poverty have less buying power. That affects me as a business owner. I have less customer. The more money that's in someone's pocket, the more chance they will buy my product. And the cool thing about living wage is that money stays locally. It still isn't enough to go to the Dominican Republic, so it stays local. So I can go to the movie, I can buy cupcakes, I will buy another pair of jeans, but I will buy it here. So if I have that money, it stays here. People who make upper income tend to take their money outside of local, and we do have that push of please pay by local. It's so important for our business owners. So when we don't understand the resources of low-income people, we judge. So when this woman that I had worked with for a period of time, generational poverty, she came to, so I was visiting her, and she said, Elaine, I have a job interview. Can you help and give me a pep talk? I'm like, absolutely. So this was before I was immersed in bridges, and I believed I was a non-judgmental a really good nurse. I go to the house, and when she opened her door, I said, I thought your job interview is today. And she goes, it is. And I said, are you wearing that? And she goes, I am. It's clean and it fits. And I'm like, that's amazing. She considered two things I've never even thought of. I've never thought of wearing dirty clothes to an interview, and I've never thought of wearing something that didn't fit me. So I'm impressed. She had two categories I had never thought of. So I'm like, okay, that's great, that's great. Do you have a sweater, a scarf, maybe a little jacket? She goes, why? You don't think the boss would think this is funny? I'm like, I don't even know who your boss is. But I think you might be putting a little bit too much of yourself out there. And she goes, why? Her t-shirt said, I am a bitch, just not yours. So, how do you know what to wear to an event? How do you know that you wear something different to a funeral than a party, that you wear something different to work than you do going out. How do you know this? Now I truly believe people Google it, how to dress for an interview. Okay, but in the old days, it was through your parents. So I, as a parenting expert, I know without a doubt it is so important to let children have choice on their clothing. But I am the parent, and I am not going to let you go to school in a beer commercial or a halter top, because I know first impressions make a big difference, and I want you to consider maybe try not to, how we make our first impression and why that's not great. Okay.
Keep going. We're just going to do this.
Okay.
Just so you're
Oh,
safe.
I know I move so much. No, sorry. Okay. So how we dress. So for her, no one would have told her that that wasn't an appropriate interview outfit. For her, being a person of generational poverty, she's a tough a young lady. She doesn't want anybody messing with her. She can tell you up front, you know, don't you be messing with me. So it's really important to think about how we know the rules and what are the hidden rules and why we dress a particular way. We did have a woman work at Public Health who wore square dancing dresses to work. And she wore the crinolines and the neon green and the neon pink, and she'd swish around, and people talked about it. They'd be like, that's so not professional. That is, like, so weird. So I pulled out the dress code policy and said, well, it's not spaghetti straps, and there's no slogan on her dresses, and it's the appropriate length, and... You know, it doesn't say on this dress code, no square dancing dresses allowed. So if we aren't clear in our rules, they become hidden. This one was my favorite. I was in the hospital recently, and I'm in one of the waiting rooms, and there's a big sign in the MRI waiting room. It says, language will not be tolerated. So I go up to the reception and I'm like, what does that mean? Am I not supposed to talk? Like, what, you know what it means. I said, no, please explain it. Explain what that means. Language will not be tolerated. She goes, well, obviously it means bad language. I'm like, obviously? I said, the people who you want that message to will never get it from that sign. Never. Okay, so 2 weeks later it was pulled down, so that's good. So externally, we have less buying power. We do make more judgment if we don't understand what it's like to live in poverty. We will have more people in the system. When we have people in the system, that's less customer base, and it's harder on our taxes. Healthcare costs, billions. Billions and billions. A doctor said once, if I could prescribe income, we would have a healthier population, because money is the biggest cause of poor health. And this is why Public Health is so committed to this message, that money actually makes you unhealthy, or the lack of it. So the more money you have, the longer you get to live. If you are living in poverty, which is not enough money for rent, transportation and accommodation, those are basics. If you don't have enough money for that, you are living in poverty. And when you live in poverty, your health hurts. You will die 21 years prematurely compared to someone who is appropriately resourced. So that's really important. And again, it affects the bottom line, putting our community into a point of being instable, so being it affects the instability of our community. Oh, this is the one that works. So what does instability look like? Instability looks like if my driving force is relationships. My daughter was in Carleton, and she phoned around Thanksgiving, and she goes, Mom, I've been messing around, and I think I'll fail if I come home for Thanksgiving. And I'm like, you stay there, work hard, we'll Skype you and send you a care package. A person from low income put up their hand and said, Elaine, don't you love your daughter? I'm like, oh, of course I love my daughter. I even like her. She's like so much fun. She says, why wouldn't you make her come home? Why wouldn't you make her come home? Because I want her to achieve. And I know my relationship, in fact, can handle a missed appointment. But if I lived in poverty, that relationship is more important than achievement, that I would say, you get home. Your grandparents haven't seen you since August. If you don't find a way to get home, I'm sending Uncle Ray and he's bringing you home. Because you are my asset. Did that tell me to stop? I'm still good, right? So that driving force can sometimes be very confusing in the business world. Lack of resources. If I don't have a car and the bus is late, my second day of employment, do you believe me? See, if I showed up late here, this would be bad, but if I showed up late for a place where they really know me, my credibility actually trumps the fact that I'm late. But if I didn't have credibility and my car broke down and I was late for the presentation, and I give a great presentation, people will forgive me. But if I'm late the second time for a presentation, people will start to talk. Yeah, she's really good, but believe me, like she really struggles with getting here on time. You start losing your credibility. So what happens if you don't know me, I'm working really hard, I managed to get through the interview, I managed to get hired, and now the bus is late, or my friend promised to drive me but didn't have money for gas, and I don't get to work on time. If I'm already triggering in my head, who did I hire? I will not engage with what some of those barriers are for that person who's under-resourced. And employment is the one way of helping that resource. So how can I keep someone employed? So the transitioning to the workplace. I did tell this story last night, and I really want you to think about it. If you are hiring someone from generational low income, the transition into a middle income organization takes time and takes buddies. Right? You need a buddy system a little bit. That's why we have orientations, right? Welcome into our agency. Here's some of the things we work with. Here's some of the resources you're going to need. So my daughters wanted me to get into Aquafit, and I'm like, no, I would hate it. No, Mom, you would really like it. No, I wouldn't. I would hate it. I hate being wet. I hate having a bathing suit on. I'm not going to like it. No, Mom, you got to try it. It's so good for your health. I'm not doing it. Right? This is sort of contemplating, but pre-contemplating is I don't want to do Aquafit. So one day they come down, all three of them have their bathing suits on, and they're like, well, we're going to Aquafit. So you can come if lunch, like you're not going without me. So I quickly get my bathing suit on and go. For 3 weeks, the three of them drag me to Aquafit. And we're actually increasing numbers. So we're instead of doing two a week, we're doing 3 a week. Now I'm up to 4 a week. At 4 a week, they don't want to do Aquafit 4 times a week, so they spell off. It's like, you take Mom Monday, I'll take her Tuesday, you take her Thursday. So I sort of knew they were spelling me off, but as long as someone came, I still felt okay. After about 3 months where I was religiously going to Aquafit, I get ready, I come downstairs, they're all hanging out with their computers, and I'm like, who's taking me to Aquafit? They're like, Mom, you've got it. You're on your own. So when that changed behavior became now active behavior, they bowed out of the support. So we need to do that for people who haven't naturally grown up in an achievement world, and they grew up more in that unstable way of looking for food, looking for rent, moving often, and who kept them alive is people. So relationships are vitally important. If I have a loaf of bread and you have a jar of peanut butter, both our kids are eating tonight. So that they actually hanging on to a neighbor is like hanging on to $1 million. So that is your asset base, is people, even if they hurt you a bit. So if we are going to transition, what support does someone need to transition from living in poverty or living on assistance to the workplace? And a lot of times the problem solving is destabilized because I might be working on a plan, but the toilet overflows or a bill comes that I wasn't aware of. The teacher's calling because Johnny went to school without lunch. So my problem solving is minute to minute and very concrete. Hard to plan long term when I can't fix today. So what happens? What does it look like to be in an unstable environment? When you live with instability at a regular basis, these are the things that you put on your juggling wheel. So when I'm living in poverty, I am regularly worried about transportation. You know, how will I get to my job regularly? A woman, she's getting her kids ready for a doctor's appointment. Everyone's got their snowsuits. We're all ready to go out the front door. And Peter poops his pants. And I say, oh, crap. And I quickly change the diaper, get into my reliable vehicle, and I get to the doctor on time. Now I'm a woman of poverty. I got my three kids in their snowsuits. They're standing at the door to go, and Peter poops his pants. I have a decision to make. If I decide to change that child's diaper, I miss my bus and I no-show my agency. And if I no-show my agency two, three, or four times, whatever the policy is, they discharge me. So I put Stinky Peter on the bus and get judged. Oh my gosh, you should have changed him. Have respect for the rest of us. When I get to the doctor's office, I still have to change Peter's diaper. And the nurse said when this patient arrived, if you want to be motivated, you're just going to have to get up earlier. Okay? So that's a transportation issue, but it comes out as a judgment on the person wasn't prepared enough. So transportation for jobs, for engaging in community, for getting to needed appointments is really important. And we need to have a public transit system that is reliable and can get me on time at least 95% of the time. Okay, things happen, but is it reliable enough? Are my friends reliable enough to get me there? Is my car reliable enough? So my car breaks down regularly, but I've never missed an appointment because I'm resourced. I can call CAA, I can call my dad, someone from work will come and get me. So if you're resourced, having a well-running car is actually a little bit less important than when you're under-resourced. Family and friends, as I said, are the driving force, which is why relationships become the driving force. All my friends and families keep me alive. So if I knock on a door of a planned home visit and the client is not there, I full-heartedly believe a relationship just trumped me. Okay? Someone that was keeping that person alive is more important than the public health nurse talking about parenting, eating apples, or reading to your children. Okay, who keeps me alive? Crime and safety, sometimes poverty and mental health are criminalized. Sometimes we don't have enough systems in our community to look after people in the right facility, so they end up in jail to stay safe. If they stay long enough, they end up having records, which makes them less employable. So again, what do we do for people who can't pay a parking infraction where now there's a warrant out for their arrest? Middle-income people don't go to jail for things like that. Once we were talking to a staff sergeant, and the staff sergeant says, we arrested a real criminal last night. And I'm like, well, you are police services. That's a great thing. And the response was, no, this person wasn't poor, didn't have mental health problems, and broke the law. She goes, it's about 10% of our arrests that look like real crime that police services are doing. So picture how much money it costs in our healthcare and in our police services to look after poverty as being the primary place or mental health. So typically when I do a whole presentation, I'm going to talk about all those things. I do want to talk about entertainment because entertainment most certainly is something middle-income people criticize the most. Why do you have a big screen TV and didn't pay your rent? When you live in poverty, every single day is the tyranny of the moment. What do I have to do today to live for today? So I have to find food. I have to maybe get enough money together that I can pay at least half my rent so that the landlord won't kick me out. My mom's sick and she doesn't have a way into the hospital. And, you know, I do have a hole in my bathroom that I can see into my laundry room. I've been fighting my landlord to get that fixed. So I live in the tyranny of the moment. So I want to put out a visual. If we were caught in a hurricane and you were all in the water and you're drowning, how many people would say, I wish I had taken my PhD? No. You don't dream a future story when you are in crisis mode. When you are in crisis mode, there is no future story. You have to look after today. So when we have brain space to think of our future, we do think of our hobbies. Maybe I'd like to learn to play the piano. Maybe I'd like to go back and get my master's. Maybe I would like to downsize and have more money for engaging in things versus being it all into my mortgage. When you have brain space, you can think of future. When you don't have brain space because you are worried about your basics, you make immediate decisions, concrete decisions, and that TV is your only relief to the pain of poverty. So if I have that big screen TV and I can turn it on for an hour and dream my life isn't here, that gives me a legal break from living in the tyranny. If I have a TV party and invite people over, that's good because they bring food and I didn't feed my kids tonight. So though they'll eat a bunch of cheesies, they won't go to bed hungry. Won't go to bed nourished, but they won't go to bed hungry. And you bring resources when you come to my TV party. I didn't know you had a 13-year-old who could walk my 5-year-old to school. So entertainment is vital, vital for someone to live in poverty. If I told you all, if you are living in middle income, you in fact cannot have any fun until you have $1 million in the bank. No fun. No chocolate bars, no movie, no anything that costs money, no skiing, no hobbies. Would you think that's fair? Would you think that's a balanced life? Our leisure is so important to us because that what makes us good for work. When we have downtime, our brains regenerate. We have love and passion about things. So it is really important that leisure is for all human beings and not just the ones who can afford it. But I will never be able to afford a big screen TV as long as my expenses are higher than my income. So what does the model of stability look like? So when you are resourced appropriately and have enough money to look after your basic needs, you in fact can engage in the community much differently. And again, middle income people love the question of, what do you do? It's a great way of learning if someone's trustworthy. Oh, who are you? What do you do? Do you have a partner? What does he do? Do you have children? What are they doing? It's all about doing. We really, really want to know what everyone's doing. We even start very young, little kids, 2-year-olds. What do you want to be when you grow up? It is all about doing in middle income because achievement is the driving force. So I had a business owner say to me once, and the language was not respectful, but he said, I'd rather hire new Canadians than white trailer trash. Now, what he didn't know was new Canadians often come quite resourced. They're poor in our country, but they actually weren't poor when they got here or before they got here. They may have been professionals. They may have been middle income. So they came with middle income ideas of working in a job that maybe doesn't fit my skill package, but will get food on the table, and then I can refine my skill package. When we talk generationally poor, it is not a middle income person without resources. It is someone who's never had resources. So it takes 3 generations to make a generationally middle-income person, wealthy person, or poor person. I'm poor, my parents are poor, and my grandparents were poor. I am generationally poor. poor. But if I was in middle income and lost my job tomorrow, I would be situationally poor. I still have my gift of gab. I still have my degree. I still have lots of connections. That makes me employable again. So what we do know is that the environment and resources are vitally important to stability. The hidden rules and language can affect how much that stability is, and it gives us opportunity when we have them both together to actually create that retention, performance, and profits for our business. The mental model of business is about employee retention. So how do I hold employees who came from generational low income? There is strategies to help someone, just like the Aquafit story. How do I buddy someone from low income to understand the hidden rules of class? You don't actually tell your boss to F off, okay? It's usually not helpful, and there's a good chance you could be unemployed tomorrow. I want to be employed tomorrow, so I regulate my emotions to make sure that I'm not offensive, which goes along with that effective communication. Promote from within. You know, if you can promote from within, you are saying you are part of my business family and I want to look after you and use your skills the best way possible. How do I help with performance enhancing? Do I do regular staff days or PD days? My productivity would go up. And we are going to see a video on Rhino, and I want to tell you about his retention when he put bridges in place. So you can see all of the things that are important to have stability in a business. So we build the stability in the business with how do we shift our corporate culture? How do we explore external resources for employees not offered by the business? So I know a lot of companies have done this. Hey, we live right beside, or our company lives beside the Y or Movati. Can we get a partnership with a fitness organization? We don't have one in our own building, but if we have a reduced membership to another one, that's a great way of looking after the health and wealth of your employees. Learn the hidden rules. Do know that, I just would like to ask, has anyone in this room never used the F word, ever? I know it's kind of embarrassing to put up your hand, but seriously. Okay, so if everyone here has used, oh, is that you? You've, Mike, you've never used the F word, perfect. That's what someone else asked me. They're like, do you mean like within the last hour? So how do you know not to use it when you are in a professional meeting? That's a hidden rule. So middle income people use the word, they use it in a setting where they know it would be more acceptable. So if I've got someone swearing, but I know they are really good at this job, how can I help them learn the language of business? Because if they learn the language of business, they're less likely to break a hidden rule of the company. And that helps with retention, performance, and profits. So you want to train everybody in bridges so that people understand their own hidden rules that can conflict with someone else's. So I'll just quickly go through the hidden rules. The hidden rules on money. When you're in poverty, it is meant to be spent. You never know when you're going to have that cash in your hand again, so you spend it. There has not been a lot of value in saving money when you live in poverty, because I finally get a nice little pile, and then something big happens, and I have to use it for that. I get a little pile, and then my daughter comes home, and she has no money for diapers or formula, so I give it to her because that is the most needed part right now. So saving is not really reinforced when you have so little. In middle income, they try to manage their money. If I got $10 million, I'd be pretty happy. I know I would never have that amount of money in my hand, but I would instantly put it into my middle income management. I can pay off the bills, I'm going to put some in for investment, I'm going to open up some businesses for my girls so that they have a good start. Where a wealthy person would say, that's ridiculous, that $10 million could grow to $20 million inside of 10 years. Why don't you save it? Because I don't have 10 years. I have five to 10 as a middle-income person. A wealthy person has decades, and people of low income have minutes to days. Their time frame is short because it matters what's happening right now. So there are 14 of the hidden rules. Each category looks at it a little bit differently. In language, if you are working with survival, you most certainly have casual language. I don't want my child's head to get hurt. I look over, I see she's jumping on an unsafe thing, and I say, sit down. But when I have strong language skills, I might say, hun, when you're jumping and the bus takes off, you will hit your head. So you need to sit down or kneel down to stay safe. Both parents did not want their child's head hit, but one of them was worried about rent, one of them was worried about food, the other one wasn't. So one built concrete skills, sit down, stop that, you know, give that back, and someone else is creating the language of negotiation. So people that have high language skills actually negotiate for themselves at a much better rate. So what that business model would look like is the employee should be in the center, a resource guidance. If I came from poverty, have I ever opened a bank account? Do I actually know what I need to do to keep my fees the lowest possible? So that would be good if it was actually part of my workplace that they would teach me. Because if they're kind of like my family, I might trust them. Education, how will I educate you for this job? Is it just a skills job that I'm going to keep showing you how to do more? Transportation, how will I get you there? Cascade Engineering used the Bridges model, and one of the things he did for transportation, because we know how chaotic it is in the first year of employment for new employees, he gave bus passes to everyone for 1 year. By then, they would have had their second raise and were able to buy their own bus pass. For people who lived on the outskirts, he gave taxi vouchers, and for a whole year, they got their way to and from work. But people who lived rurally, he went to faith-based organizations and said, who here wants to keep people out of poverty? He got a huge population of people that he called Angel Wings, and their job was to drive to the house, get the employee, and bring the employee into work every day. And in 1 year, they had saved enough money to buy their own used car. But a lot of them stayed with their transportation person because it was an adopted grandparent, because it was about the relationship. Hey, when you're working, bring your laundry. I'll throw in a couple loads for you. Or, you know what? Do you want to stop at the grocery store on the way home and get your groceries? So that became a relationship that actually built his company. He is very progressive, but also he's making a lot of money. He opened his second. So that's Cascade Engineering. And he does have two engineering companies that are high in profits while looking after people. And then that coaching and mentoring, again, do I know how to talk to my boss? Do I know how to open a bank account? Do I know how to talk to the principal or the teacher at school so that my child stays in the academic stream? So what are your expected outcomes when you live in, or for your businesses? Is when we understand we can reduce conflicts, we can stabilize people, and when we stabilize, our business becomes stabilized. So it pays to stabilize your employee first so that your company will be stabilized as well. So think out of the box. As an organization, what can you do? You know, we put food out for kids in school because we know fed brains actually think better. Do you have some supplements that you can put out for someone who's maybe coming with a pretty, pretty scarce lunch? Some granola bars, some apples, just something that someone can seriously pick up if they're hungry. Do you have carpools? Do you have a way to create a buddy system that allows someone to come? If you do have someone who's homeless that seems to sit outside of your business, is there a way to engage them in your business? You know, to be a greeter, to sweep the sidewalk in a way of saying, I know you're important as a person, and is there a way that he or she could become an employee? So it is really important. And as businesses, Cam was saying, things like Christmas hampers and all those things that you would like to help, consider adding to Guelph's microcredit. We have a microcredit of $25,000 in Meridian that looks after circles, and everyone who's part of a circles has access to no interest loans. And with those loans, they don't have to go to payday lenders in order to get loans at a high interest rate. They can't apply for credit cards because their history is not strong enough. But when you get a microloan from credit the credit union, Meridian, that you will actually start improving your credit score as well as having access to smaller amounts of money that you don't have to use a payday lender for. So the businesses that I have presented to, I've presented to Purolator, Guelph Hydro, I've done credit counseling all over Canada. Cascade and Rhino are both in the States, and they are companies that use, what time are we? Oh, we're late. This is about, this video is about 7 minutes, so I'm not going to play it, but it shows, it's a high-quality cookie dough company. His name is Ted Castle, and he agrees that he will never make more than 20 amounts, his average employee. And so he goes, I make sure my average employees are paid well, because then I get 20 times. And he has no B product. He has not, since he put this in place, he has never sold a B cookie, because everyone feels so committed to the business that they perform at the top rate. He has one of the lowest turnover rates, high retention rate, and people move within the organization and they are pleased to be there. And he also offers a microloan through his organization. So look him up on YouTube, Ted Castle. He has agreed. Louise and I have spoke to him directly, and he has agreed if businesses in Guelph want to hear his plan, he would come to speak with us about how he's run that. So sorry, I have so much to say in such a short time frame. I hope, as Cam said, that you get an aha process out of that and that you're interested to hear more and start thinking about what it looks like to be raised in a certain amount of financial wealth. So I, again, really thank Cam for giving us the opportunity to be here. I do want to share one other piece. Just this week, I was called by the Mount Forest Mayor's office. They want to do the same thing. They did say Cam was, like, extremely handsome, and that's why they wanted to follow. I'm totally kidding. But they did see the poverty dialogue and have booked me for March 28th, 2018. So they are also interested in seeing what can we do at a municipal level to make a difference to the people who live here. Thank you so much.
And once again, that was Elaine Weir of Bridges Out of Poverty. You can learn more about that program at circlesgw.ca/bridges-out-of-poverty. And you can follow Bridges Out of Poverty at Twitter at Bridges Out of POV, all one word. And that's all for the Guelph Politicast this week. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And of course, you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we'll have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.